for argument is Bjornson versus Astru. Mr. Schiff.
May it please the court, Jim Schiff on behalf of plaintiff appellant Christine Bjornson. This is a Social Security disability case in which the administrative law judge made several errors in his decision. We raised two arguments on appeal. The first is that the ALJ's credibility finding was insufficient because he failed to properly credit the plaintiff's debilitating headaches. And second, that the ALJ improperly failed to give great weight to the opinions of plaintiff's treating physician and consultative examiner. This court held in Indoronto v. Barnhart that in evaluating a claimant's credibility, the ALJ must consider subjective complaints of pain if the claimant can establish a medically determinable impairment that could reasonably be expected to produce the pain. Here, the ALJ found that Ms. Bjornson's medically determinable impairment of a Chiari malformation could reasonably be expected to produce her symptom of chronic headaches, but then he found that the intensity, persistence, and limiting effects of these headaches were not credible and would not have prevented her from performing sedentary work. And the reasons he gave for this finding were that she complained of headaches only occasionally after 2003, and that she did not seek regular treatment for the headaches after 2003. However, the evidence shows that she complained of headaches at least six times prior to the expiration of her insured status and nine times after. And of the 11 times she saw her treating physician before the expiration of her insured status, she complained of headaches six out of those 11 times. We also contend that even if she...
Do we have medication records for this period of time up to the expiration of insured status? Is she buying Motrin for these? I mean, they sound... The occipital neuralgia sounds pretty severe. I'm not sure if over-the-counter medication would do it.
I do know that she was taking Percocet and methadone.
The record shows.
The record does show.
Yes, but when was that? You know, these dates are important. So.
Well, before the expiration of insured status, which is June 30th, 2005, we do know she was taking narcotic pain medications for her headaches, but they were also used for her back pain.
So they're just for both. You couldn't really separate.
Right. And even if she did not complain of headaches every time she saw her treating physician, there was no reason for her to continue to complain, as there was nothing that doctors could do to further alleviate her headache pain. And Dr. Goodman actually stated that her headaches were continuous, they varied in intensity, they were always present, and she was always aware of them. A particular note here is a treatment note from her treating neurologist, Dr. Sito, on February 17, 2004. And he stated that Ms. Bjornson still had intermittent fluid collections in the back of her head. And she also had chronic headaches and back pain. So what that note shows is that even after the time which the ALJ found that her disability would have ended, she was still having the residual effects of this surgery. And another neurologist, Dr. De Gianfilippo, noted several years later that there was no more surgery that he could do without risking the condition of hydrocephalus occurring.
Well, this is when they were talking about taking the shunt out?
Right.
Yeah.
And that was in 2008. Mm-hmm. And Ms. Bjornson was aware that as long as the shunt remained in her head, she would continue to suffer from these debilitating headaches. And the only relief she could get was from lying down and taking these pain medications. And so we thought it was unreasonable for the ALJ to discredit her headaches simply because she stopped having surgeries, even though she had already had seven of them. And SSR 96-7P, I'm sorry, Social Security ruling 96-7P, states that an ALJ must consider the individual's explanations for why they do not seek particular treatments, particularly if they have been advised by a medical source that no further effective treatment would be available for her.
So the Chiari malformation is eventually fixed?
No, Your Honor. She continued to have the fluid collections in the back of her head. After 2003, she did not have any further surgery.
But that's the protrusion of the brain tissue. I thought, I understand that the fluid problem continues, but does the brain keep pushing down into the spinal canal?
Well, Ms. Bjornson testified that the brain remained essentially pushed into the spinal canal, even though the actual malformation, she did not have any malformation surgeries. The record isn't really clear on whether she continued to have the malformations themselves. But the record is clear, based on her testimony and the records from Dr. Goodman, that she was having headaches after 2003. She testified she had these headaches 4 to 5 days a week. On days that she had these headaches, she could not do much besides lay in bed. She could not take care of her child on the days she had the headaches because her pain medications made her heavily sedated.
Now, that was after the date last insured, though. The child isn't, the younger one, isn't born until after that date, right?
So that's
correct. We're being asked to extrapolate backwards from that evidence.
Well, she did testify that her older son, who was a teenager, she was actually unable to wake him up for school, that she had to call him on his cell phone from her bedroom in order to wake him up. She simply couldn't move.
He was apparently a lighter sleeper than my son was, who could sleep through any telephone call.
And so we believe it's unreasonable for the ALJ to say that her activities supported that she could perform sedentary work. We believe her activities were quite limited. In fact, she was only able to shop with assistance. She cooked occasionally. She had the assistance of her mother, her mother-in-law, and her sister with all child care.
Are you making the argument, for example, that you might be able to dress yourself even though you have a wild headache?
Yes.
I mean, because I thought that's, in a sense, what you were saying, that some of these daily activities didn't rule out the possibility that the headache was so severe.
Yes. An individual's ability to dress herself doesn't discredit the headaches, because what we're dealing with is whether the headaches were severe enough to prevent work. And the rulings and the cases say that daily activities, minimal daily activities, should not be equated with full-time work because they allow flexibility in time and the amount of time it takes to do an activity, where full-time work is a strict schedule that someone would have to adhere to.
So what's your best evidence in this record that she really, I mean, usually the vocational experts will say if you're going to miss as many as 2 days of work a month regularly, you can't hold down a full-time job. Is it these doctors? Is it her husband? What are you primarily relying on?
Well, actually, the vocational expert in this case did testify that an individual who missed more than 2 days of work a month would be unemployable.
Unemployable. Okay, so that's a standard statement they say. And so where do we get the 2 days from?
Well, Ms. Bjornson testified that she had debilitating headaches 4 to 5 days a week, and she testified that holding down a job would be hard for her because she would call in several times a week. She testified that if she had 2 to 3 days a week that she didn't have a headache, that would be remarkably good. And I believe the best evidence is actually the note from Dr. Sito from February 17, 2004, showing that after the surgery she continued to have these headaches. And that goes against what the ALJ found, was that essentially he's finding her not credible to the extent she's not having surgeries anymore. And that even goes against what the medical expert said, which is that, the residuals of her Chiari malformation decompression surgery are reasonably expected to cause headaches.
Are you talking about Dr. Ezeke at this point?
Right.
Yeah.
So all that Dr. Ezeke said was that there wasn't anything he saw in the record that would prevent her from performing sedentary work. But he didn't actually address the headaches.
What did she have besides headaches?
She had low back pain. She had degenerative disc disease. She was obese. She had depression.
You didn't mention obesity in your brief, did you?
That's correct. The headaches, we believe, is the most compelling.
It would aggravate her back pains, wouldn't it?
Yes.
Why didn't you mention it?
Well, the focus of our brief is on the headaches because Ms. Bjornson actually testified that the back pain was something that she could deal with, but the headaches were something that she could not deal with under any circumstance. So we believe that was more compelling evidence, at least for the purposes of this appeal.
Well, I know, but we keep telling the ALJs they have to look at everything, right? You add up a lot of non-disabling ailments, you get disability, right?
Well, absolutely, the ALJ should have considered everything.
Is back hurting? Is her head hurting? No. Even if she can live with the back pain, it certainly make work difficult for her, on top of the headaches, even if not by themselves. Anyway, that's the detail.
How old is she?
She was in her early 40s. She's in her early 40s currently. She was about 38 at the time of the hearing.
I know a feature of the, I guess the, he used the word basket case.
Right.
I haven't heard since my mother used that, but I guess that's one reference to somebody that you got to be in pretty bad shape before she wins.
Right. The ALJ's use of that term as a means of discrediting her, we believe, was inappropriate because...
Well, was it? I thought he was just saying that the grid is very severe, is very tough on people under 50. Is that what he meant? I'm not sure. I couldn't find it in the record when he was... Do you know what page?
Yes, it's 181.
I thought what he was saying was that the grids helped you if you were, quote, old, but they didn't. I have to add that. But they didn't help you if you were below the age, but then he added you'd really have to be a basket case. And I thought what you were saying was that that was actually too strong a standard. I'm not sure what you think a basket case is, but unable to hold down a job.
Well,
might not be the same thing.
I guess my impression of what the ALJ was saying was that an individual over 50 is automatically disabled. An individual under 50 cannot be disabled.
So you just have to prove it on the facts.
Right.
If you're under 50, you don't have to show that you're drooling.
Right. You just have to show you're not capable of sustaining full-time work. And actually, three other circuits, the 2nd, 8th, and 9th Circuit, have specifically held that an individual does not have to be a, quote, basket case before the courts will find
that. What he said was... he says... Well, it's all gibberish, really, but... He says, it's harder to do that when you're younger because there's no rules in your favor. I'd have to find that you're just a basket case. So the lawyer says, no, not just a basket case, Judge, that you can't handle full-time work on a sustained basis. So the ALJ says, well, the same. That's so many words.
If I may discuss the medical opinions.
I haven't read a record like this in a while.
The medical opinion issue, we believe, is also important to address because the ALJ made several errors in evaluating the opinion of the consultative examiner, Dr. Rafiq. And Dr. Rafiq examined Ms. Bjornsson following the first hearing. There were two hearings. And he concluded that she could sit, stand, and walk for a total of 3 hours in an 8-hour day. And he said that in the remaining 5 hours a day, she would be lying down.
And Dr. Rafiq, as I recall, was an agency consultative doctor. He had no relationship with Ms. Bjornsson, right?
That's correct.
But he didn't examine her.
He did.
He did.
He did
He's the one who did.
Aziki's
the one who didn't.
So we believe it was improper for the ALJ to discredit the opinion of a government doctor. And the ALJ actually asserted that he believed that Dr. Rafiq was sympathizing with Ms. Bjornsson, but there's no evidence to support that. And it was unreasonable for the ALJ to assume a doctor with no relationship to the patient would bend over backwards to issue an opinion that's not based.
And Rafiq, who employs Rafiq?
The Social, I'm sorry, the Bureau of Disability Determination Services.
The state.
Right.
So he's a salaried doctor. He's not paid by. He's not her doctor.
That's correct.
He's not paid by Blue Cross or anything.
No.
You save the rest of your time.
Oh, yes. Thank you, Your Honors.
Mr. Goldstein?
May it please the Court. We believe that the fundamental issue in this case is that Ms. Bjornsson did not seek care, specific care for her headaches, after 2003, after her final operation for her Chiari malformation.
Some question I'd like to ask you. My first is it common for ALJs to refer to applicants by their first name?
Maybe her last name's hard to pronounce.
Consider that appropriate?
I don't know.
I consider it extremely inappropriate.
inappropriateness is noted, Your Honor.
You mentioned the or it came up in the previous argument, in Mr. Schiff's argument, this business of events before and after June 2005. What did the ALJ mean when he said the claimant's symptoms and treatment after June 2005 are useful for reference? What does "for reference" mean?
Yeah, I'm not sure what the ALJ meant by "for reference." Now, sometimes if there's treatment or medical evidence immediately after June 2005, that could reflect.
So we don't know what he's talking about. Now, you defend in your brief, let's say, I find it extremely unconvincing, the notion that by creating what you call templates, the Social Security Administration is facilitating the, you know, rational determination of these cases. Now, the Social Security has this new piece of boilerplate, which I find even more opaque than the last one. And that's this thing about, I forget where it is. That's the one which says that the symptoms, the medical records, and so on, could have produced, you know, what the evidence could have produced, could justify what she was arguing, but it's not fully, but she's not fully credible because her testimony is inconsistent with the above residual functional capacity determination.
I think it's on page 24, or at least one of the places.
24.
R 24.
Right.
Page 9,
okay.
Of 12,
I'm sorry.
At the end
yes.
Of that paragraph.
Yes. Yeah. So, but there was no above the residual functional capacity. It came below, right?
It actually comes above and below, Your Honor.
Pardon?
The residual functional capacity is stated both above and below.
Discussion of visit. Oh, it's page 21. I'm sorry. Yeah. Okay.
Yes. It's at page 21.
Okay. 20 to 21. Last the carryover sentence. After careful consideration of the evidence, as opposed to what, careless consideration? Usually he's careless, but today he decided to be careful, or he's always careful. Anyway, after careful consideration. The undersigned finds that claimant's medically determinable impairments could reasonably be expected to cause the illness. However, the claimant's statements concerning intensity, persistence, limiting effects are not credible to the extent that they are inconsistent with the above residual functional capacity assessment. Now, there isn't an above assessment. The assessment comes later, right? But what I particularly don't understand is, how can you separate the evidence from the assessment of above the assessment of residual functional capacity? Because obviously the evidence determines what her capacity is. So what does this mean? Does this have any meaning? This valuable template, which you defend in your brief, what is the meaning of it? Can't be very valuable if it's meaningless.
The template in itself is
and what does it mean?
What it means is that everything is not credible if it's, as a template statement, everything is not credible if it's more limiting than the RFC, the residual functional capacity.
What does that add to just saying that the determination of the RFC is going to have a big effect on the determination of this? Where does the credibility come in with it?
Here it doesn't.
It doesn't. It's just nonsense.
It says that they're not credible to the
extent. How is this valuable to the social, to the administrative law judges to have this on their computer and plugged in their opinion? How does that make life easier for them? It's totally opaque. Let me ask you another thing that bothers me. So the administrative law judge is indignant at the thought that Dr. Goodman says she's totally disabled. Is it Goodman? Says, no, that's the business of the ALJ. On the other hand, one of the reasons he gives so much weight to Ezekiel is he says Ezekiel is familiar with the Social Security program. Well, that's contradictory, right? Because that's saying, well, Ezekiel, I know your standards, and she's fine, right? How is his familiarity with the Social Security program relevant to his determination of her headaches?
When Ezekiel says that Ms. Dornchin could perform sedentary work, if Ezekiel
perform sedentary work,
that's an ALJ function.
Yeah.
He has no
that's
business saying that.
That's an opinion.
When Goodman says she can't work, he's the ALJ is angry at him for saying that. When Ezekiel says it, fine.
Well, no, it's
yes, fine.
There's a difference. Dr. Ezekiel said, I opine. What's your opinion? I opine that she can perform sedentary work. The ALJ didn't have to accept that opinion, but the ALJ can say.
And gave his opinion. She can't work at all because of her headaches. What's the difference between saying she can do sedentary work and she can't do any work? They're both opinions by doctors.
The regulations say that the reserve that opinion that
then
you
why
can't.
Is it, why are you saying he can pay attention to Zeke when he says she can't do sedentary work?
Let's say that Dr. Goodman said sedentary work. Would
Goodman says she can't do so. This is some magic word thing. If he says she can't work, then that's fine. But if he says she's disabled, that's
no, that's the same thing. Can't work, disabled. It's the same thing. I'm saying sedentary work.
She can work, and Goodman says she can. And it's okay for Ezekiel to say that, but it's not okay for Goodman. No,
they didn't say the same thing, Your Honor. Ezekiel said sedentary work, and that's okay to say. And Goodman could have said that, too, but didn't. Goodman said couldn't work at all. Those are different things.
But it's a different opinion.
You can't work at all, it means you can't do sedentary work.
Maybe. Who knows what someone has in mind?
If someone says you can't do work.
I don't think we have to argue about it, Your Honor, when that's what the regulations say. That's what the regulations say.
What? That you can say you can't do sedentary work, but if you say you can't do any work, that's inadmissible?
It's not inadmissible, but it's reserved to this commissioner.
But I don't understand you, because if someone says you can't do any work, that means, that includes, you can't do sedentary work.
Not necessarily.
Oh, come on. What language are we discussing? If I say...
It happens all the time. Doctors write opinions. They can't work. They might think workers' comp. Who knows what standard they have in mind when they say can't work.
That's not what Dr. Goodman was doing. Dr. Goodman gives a fairly lengthy thing, and he winds up saying... She really can't do anything. I mean, certainly if somebody was in an accident and they broke their neck and they were in bed and, you know, under 24-hour care, some doctor would be allowed to say, John Smith can't work.
But
I mean, that's not some fancy workers' comp or...
Right, but the reason that the administrative law judge rejected Dr. Ezekiel's opinion is because and accepted Dr. Ezekiel's opinion was because Dr. Ezekiel said
what he wanted to hear.
No, said Dr. Goodman's opinion is not substantiated. Dr. Goodman said, I didn't treat primarily headaches. I didn't provide medication for headaches. It was just, if it helped, it helped. But I was treating the back pain. I wasn't treating headaches. That's what Dr. Goodman said. Dr. Goodman said, I had no idea what the intensity of the headaches was. Can you imagine? You go to the doctor and you say, I have headaches. And the doctor doesn't say, tell me about the intensity. She says they're making me vomit. They're knocking me out 4 or 5 times a week. And her treating doctor doesn't know that.
But he's the back doctor, so maybe she figures he's the wrong person to talk to. Some headaches do that to people.
And that's the other thing. She's not talking to anyone. Her neurologist, she went to Dr. Sito, her first neurologist, and his last note in February of 2004, the same month that Appellant's counsel was attaching so much importance to, he wrote in his note, she only complains of some headaches. And then she doesn't go to another neurologist until 2006.
But you're disregarding all of her testimony. I guess that just doesn't count, huh?
No, it counts. But it has to be reflected.
She was a liar.
That's what it is. Not a liar, but not credible, whatever.
Oh, wait a second. If she says she vomits and she has headaches and so on, and it's not true, then she's a liar.
At least as of June of 2005.
Did he say she was a liar?
He said she's not credible.
Did he say she was not credible, or is that just buried in that piece of boilerplate we were discussing?
I don't know, Your Honor.
Why did he think that Dr. Rafiq might be testifying out of sympathy? I mean, I understand with a treating doctor, of course, being paid by the patient. So I understand that, but he doesn't have any relationship with her. Why? He's a disability doctor. He works for the government.
He doesn't work.
They don't
for the
like government. Disabled people. He costs doesn't money.
He doesn't work for the government.
That was wrong. What your opponent said.
I believe it's wrong. Yes, he was paid by the government in this case, but he's not salaried by the government. He's not a government employee.
Yeah, he's paid by the government. He's paid by the
consultant.
He's paid by the disability service. Now, of course, we know the doctors have a bias in favor of denying disability. That's the whole goal of the Social Security Administration and its state counterparts. So why would he be bending over backwards to describe someone as disabled who wasn't? Where did the ALJ get the idea that he had that kind of bias?
How do we know that an independent consultative examiner has a bias towards denying claims?
Yeah, that would be the natural bias, because he's working for the disability agency. But my question is, what's the basis for the ALJ suspecting that he has a bias the other way?
Because there was nothing in his findings. All he's doing, she tells him, I have headaches, and that's all there is about headaches.
Yes, but headaches, you know. They often don't have. We've had this headache. This is pain, right? We've had a zillion cases saying that the fact that pain does not show up on a medical record, that is, you can't find something in the body which is generating the pain, does not permit the ALJs to disregard pain as a disabling. Condition, and that includes headaches, which is a form of pain. Now, if he said she's a liar, she doesn't have headaches, okay, that's one thing. That would be like the case we heard the fellow who went deer hunting. But the ALJ never said that, right?
Well, she's told Dr. Giuliano, her neurologist, that she could deal with her headaches.
Well, what's she supposed to do? Commit suicide?
No, she could seek treatment for them. She could get medicated for them.
But she's been narcotics. Told there was nothing else to do.
No doctor said that, though.
It'd
be nice to see that a doctor saying her going to a doctor and a doctor saying there's nothing we could do, but no doctor said that.
Understanding, I believe, in the record anyway, that there was. I mean that the. End of the line had come, surgically speaking, and there's only so much the prescription meds will do.
She wasn't getting any prescription medications specific for her headaches because she never saw a doctor specific for her headaches, and no doctor ever said there was nothing more they could do for your headaches.
Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Goldstein. So, Mr. Schiff, do you have anything further? Yeah, you had some time if you have anything.
Uh, Just a few points on rebuttal. With respect to opposing counsel's last argument, there actually is evidence on page 622 of the administrative record from Dr. DeGianfilippo. He stated that he would have considered...
Page 622?
Yes.
Whose evidence?
Gianfilippo.
Oh, DeGianfilippo. Yes, go ahead.
And he says that he would have considered revising the shunt, preventing the cerebrospinal fluid, which would have meant another surgery. But if he had done that, it would have risked another condition occurring. And that was why she did not pursue any further surgery after she had already had seven.
Even though that's what's apparently causing her continuing the headaches.
Right.
So there's, call it catch-22 or what, take them out, you got a big problem, leave them in, you got a problem.
Right. Right, and when she said that she could deal with the headaches, her way of dealing with the headaches would have prevented her from performing work, which was to lie down for the majority of the day and take pain medications, and that's still inconsistent with work. And then I also wanted to argue that Dr. Ezeke, the medical expert, his familiarity with the Social Security disability program is not in and of itself relevant to enough in and of its own for the ALJ to have afforded his way the opinion that he did. If it were, then the opinions of medical experts would always be afforded the greatest weight, and the opinions of the treating physician and examining doctors would not carry as much weight. So based on those two reasons and the reasons I argued earlier, I believe this court should reverse. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Schiff and Mr. Goles.